The truth about publishing is that book publishing is not designed for writers and artists. Those are the people that book publishing actually harms the most.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is George McCowman, author of the book Illustrated Black History, Honoring the Iconic and the Unseen. A book that started out as a Black History Month project, George had to fight the publishing industry to bring this pioneering work to the people.
And I was really kind of like, if you're going to fight me on this, I'm going to fight you more. You are in a marriage with a publisher, but it's not a democracy. And I was really kind of like, I want to work. And then I was like, no, this is actually, you guys are going to do this my way.
A classically trained artist and a native of Grenada, George says he was well overqualified to create this book after working as a graphic designer, magazine art director, newspaper columnist, and running his own design studio. Why he says rage fueled his publishing journey. Plus, how his mother's death clarified his vision. And why he believes tracing the origins of food is a more honest way to learn the history and culture of people. George shares his journey next when Black and Published continues. All right, so George, I know you are a visual artist, but this is Black and Published. So
yes.
My first question is, when did you know that you were a writer?
I have always known that I am a writer. It took me, you know, there's the internal conversation you have with yourself, and then there's a conversation you have with other people. I was a kid that grew up drawing and writing. Professionally, it took me, it was a few years ago, while I'm a columnist in San Francisco for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I started writing, and it was an illustrated column. And so I would write a lot about Bay Area culture. And then I started writing cultural essays specifically about different aspects of living in the Bay Area. And as I was doing that, I was also working on the book. And I didn't think initially I would be writing the book. But then as it progressed, as it kept taking the time it was taking, it just became clear that this was a lived-in experience for me, that I had done my own research and I had perspectives on each of the people in this book. And the writer that I was working with really invited me into the process, and we ended up writing it together, and it was a really beautiful experience.
So let's talk about how you go from being a creative child, nurturing both your writing sensibility as well as your artistic sensibility, to becoming a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and beginning again with the visuals before adding words. Why was it that you felt that you needed to write things down?
I grew up as a child that was always recording things with my eyes and my brain. And so I am that person that I have a notebook, I take notes, I write things. And now I draw things also. And so the combination of that, as well as being in the magazine industry and the publishing industry, where I've gotten, you know, I have 25, 26 years experience, I'm overqualified in terms of putting stories together. I know how to do it effortlessly. And it's an access that a lot of Black people don't have. You know, it's something I know has been my superpower in the making of this book, is that I knew how to make the book before I made the book.
I like the non-humble brag of you being overqualified. So in talking about all of your years of experience, what does that look like in your life? How are you making money as this artist, as this writer in publishing before coming to this book?
I love that question because I know everybody wants to know. I live in a part of California that is really wealthy. And people don't talk openly or honestly about where they make their money. Especially white people. Like, they don't want to tell you that they have a home because their parents bought it, or that they are existing basically on a trust. They're not always honest and forthcoming about class. And so I'm fascinated by it, because I had to figure out basically how I was going to do both. I am still running a design studio, and I was making this book. I didn't take a sabbatical. I didn't have the financial luxury to stop working to make this book. For the last 11 years, I've worked for myself. I run a branding studio that is named McCalman Co., and it's the McCalman Company. And the Co. also means collaboration. It means community. The Co. part has been the backbone of what I do as a designer. And so I was in publishing for 14, 15 years. I opened up my own studio in 2011. And so that's how I did this book, is basically my work and how I am paid by my clients subsidized a lot of the making of this book. I had to spend a lot of my own money. I had to hire outside resources aside from the resources that the publisher was giving me, because I also know the process. So I knew when I would need extra people in the sauce. And this book, in fairness to the publisher, they've never done a book like this before. And so even they didn't know how much work it was going to be. Like, basically, this book was a collaboration. You know, I had creative control over everything I did in this book, which is also not the norm, especially when the Black community is interfacing with publishing, because they're not always forthcoming and honest about this. But the process was hard and difficult. I don't want to misrepresent it. It was not an easy process at all.
We're going to get to the process, but I want to go back to what you were talking about. You worked in publishing for 14, 15 years before launching your own business, McCalman Co., which... Mm-hmm. Even though it's your business that you work, it's still your full 9-to-5, which pays.
It's my full 24/7.
Yes.
7 days a week. I work 7 days a week.
Yes. So what did you do in publishing for the time that you were in traditional publishing?
So I was a magazine art director, and I'm also a graphic designer. And I started doing that in 1995. I worked at Money Magazine. I worked at Entertainment Weekly. I worked at a lot of Time Inc. magazines in New York, which is where I grew up. I grew up in Brooklyn, East Flatbush. And then I moved out to San Francisco and continued working at magazines. So by the time I left, I had worked at so many different magazines. I knew this process inside and out. And when I opened up my studio, it was to move into marketing and advertising. But what I discovered is the way that stories are told is editorial. And so I bring that into the marketing and advertising work that I do. It is all from an editorial perspective. I'm always looking for context. I'm always kind of making sure that the overall perspective is there, not just the message, but that the packaging and the presentation is what it's supposed to be.
And I see how that lends itself to the book. We're getting there. But I want to ask, in all of your years of doing magazine art direction and graphic design and working in that capacity with words and images, when did the first inklings to do this kind of book and this big of a project come to you? And what was it about the idea that didn't leave you alone?
That is a story. I mean, the making of this book was a saga at many points. But 6 years ago, I was interested in doing a self-generated project where I wanted to paint a different Black history pioneer on a daily basis. I had been on the director side of things for a long time, but I went to school for art. I am a classically trained artist. But then, you know, being from an immigrant family, my whole family was like, how are you going to make a living? And at the time, I was like, I don't know. And so I just abandoned the idea of being an artist. And 20 years later, it was calling to me. And I was in my early 40s at the time and going through kind of a midlife existential crisis. Like, who am I? What am I doing? What is my contribution to humanity? All those things that you think about in your brain that aren't even necessarily conversations you're having with other people. So I gave myself this project. And as I was doing it, several friends said, oh, this should be a book. And Keisha, I was like, well, obviously, this is already a book. And I looked around after I finished the project. I did 29 portraits. It was a leap year. And I looked around and I was like, are you all kidding me? This does not exist. And then honestly, I got mad. I got mad because I also know the back end of the publishing industry. And I was like, I totally understand why this doesn't exist. I totally understand. This is the laziness of this industry, that people don't think that this is important enough. I knew that the reason it didn't exist is that nobody thought it was valuable enough to have a book that you could just buy and give that celebrated the accomplishments of Black pioneers. And it seemed so fundamental to me. I was like, well, if you all don't think this is important, then who is going to think that this is important? And then I realized, I'm going to think. It's me. And the journey started from there. It was me finding that in myself, realizing that, oh, I think I'm the one that has to do this.
Yes. Besides your book, the only books that have a similar vein to what you have done are the books from Vashti Harrison, another visual artist, the Little Leaders books, because I have some of those for my daughter. So yes. Let's talk about this twisting and turning story. What was your publishing process like? Because even with your intimate knowledge, you mentioned earlier that it was very difficult and under-resourced, despite all of the resources from HarperCollins.
That's right. That is the truth. And we're going to get into the Black in Black and Published right now, because that is basically what this is all about. So the story. It goes like this. I'm working on this project, and my friend Rose Wenjugu, a Kenyan woman, was like, darling, this is your calling. You have to do this. But for me, it was more of an internal process of like, wow, I know this is an undertaking. And do I really want to put myself into the publishing industry when I know how ratchet it can be? And so it took me a little bit of time. And so I sent several notes just to feel out an interest. And not surprisingly, since it is what primarily white ladies deciding who are the gatekeepers of this industry, I got all the expected white lady responses. And it was like, but well, let me think about this a little bit. I'm not sure that there's a market for this. I'm not sure like who is the audience for. Yeah, and exactly. My eyes rolled to the back of my head several times, but it wasn't just rolling to the back of my head. It enraged me. It enraged me. And I was just kind of like, okay, this is not happening, you know, because I don't want to deal with this. You know, I don't want to deal with being the only Black person who's having to represent on the team, having to represent the importance of this, who's thinking about it culturally, who's not just thinking about it technically as typically white ladies in publishing do. And so I was having an art opening, and Jen Hewitt, who is a Black Filipina textile artist, Jen pulled me aside and said, as the amazing Black woman she is, she's like, what's your problem? What are you doing? What are you waiting for? You should be doing this. And I explained to her the back end of this. And she said, of why I hadn't moved forward with this. And she said, I have an agent to introduce you to. And I ended up speaking to Kate Woodrow. And when I spoke to Kate, I was like, Kate, I'm really angry about this. And I need to know that you are going to fight for this all the way. I don't want to hear any platitudes. I don't want to hear your intentions. I want to see your actions around this. Mm-hmm. And she told me, she's like, if you can get the proposal together, which means that I would write and design a reason for the publishers, which is important for your readers to hear. Like, you have to create an outline. Mm-hmm. No one is supposed to just be excited about your idea because you're talking about it. And when I tell you I was clear about this idea 6 years ago, the book that you're looking at is the outline I wrote 6 years ago.
Okay. Because that was, as you were talking about your frustration and then sitting on it, the way the book is done, and I've seen other artists do this, is it could have been like an art project, coffee table book that you bootstrapped, Indiegogo, Kickstarter kind of campaign, and then it becomes like another piece of art that, you know, limited release, limited run, goes to the highest bidder. Once it's done, it no longer exists type of thing.
Yes. I knew I didn't want a Kickstarter, not because there's anything wrong with it, but it would basically take away from the process of making. Kickstarters are a full-time job, and I did not want to devote my time to that. I wanted the publisher to pay for it. And what I wanted the publisher to pay for was marketing and distribution. I wanted to make sure that it was not just in a certain kind of store. I wanted to make sure it was everywhere, all over the country, that you couldn't. And I designed this cover, as you see, you can see it from space.
Yeah.
You can't ignore it. If it is on the book stand, you cannot look away from this. And that's what I wanted.
So then talk about, because you said you had pretty much complete creative control and it was a partnership between you and the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like, you know, getting the contributors and going through that process, that editorial process, before it was ready to go through marketing and distribution and the publicity team to get it ready to get to the world? What was that like?
You know, there was a lot that I learned. This project is by far, and I've done more ambitious things, but this is without a doubt the hardest thing I have ever done. Like, bookmaking has a specific way that it's done. Like, this happens here and then it doesn't happen there. And they're very specific. And they basically had to redo their entire process to work with me because I redid how books are done. Because I was someone who was doing all of the pieces of it. I had to have access basically to everything. Mm-hmm. I had to talk with the publishing team. I had to talk with the printers. I had to talk with the color adjustments. I had to talk to the fact checker. Like, I hired the fact checker because the fact checking part of this book is one of the most important parts, because if you guys get it wrong, I'm the person who's going to be blamed, not you. And I want to be right with the Black community as this is coming out, because this book is going to be easily targeted if it's wrong. And if it's wrong, it's my fault. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be you. So it took them a while, to be quite honest. It took them a while to like wrap their heads around it. And they fought me a lot in terms of how, when we were doing things, how we were doing them. And I was relentless.
But how could they even fight you since you designed the cover, you wrote the biographies, you provided all the internal imagery, like all they had to do was bind it.
And that's basically what they were not used to. The truth about publishing is that book publishing is not designed for writers and artists. Those are the people that book publishing actually harms the most. Book publishers set up their process to convenience the production department and the editors of the book. It is their scheduling and their process that defines how books are made. And then the writers are slotted into that. And design is usually the last piece of the puzzle. You know, I designed this book early in the process. That's not usually how it happens. And me designing it early meant that everyone on the team got to see how I had envisioned this book looking. And they tried to redesign the book several times. Yeah. No, it was that intense.
Why? And this is just extra work that you don't need to do.
Well, they made, because how I countered it is that I just made them redo it over and over and over and over and over again. I was like, oh, no. You guys don't know that I'm not looking away from this, and I can do this all day. If you're going to fight me on this, I'm going to fight you more. Like, I had fully committed to this project, even though there were many times I didn't know if it was going to happen. Honestly, there were a few twists and turns along the way. But I really was committed to the difficulty, which I think is what overwhelms a lot of people, is that publishing is a difficult process. It's simple in its mechanics, but because human beings are involved, it's a really difficult process, and it can be, and it wears people out.
What do you think it was about your resolve that made them continue to tussle with you instead of just saying, you know what, we revoke the advance, the project is shelved, it's never coming out, he is released? Because that also is an option.
Mm-hmm. It was, and it almost got to that point a couple times where I was like, I don't think this publisher is the right publisher for this. And my mistake, honestly, early in the process, was that I was trying to be collaborative. I was trying to work with people who weren't working with me. Mm-hmm. But in the process, I was like, oh, I think I forgot that this is my book. And that is what anybody Black in publishing, I am reminding you to really trust your instincts around it, knowing that you are the generator of this idea. You are in a marriage with a publisher, but it's not a democracy. And I was really kind of like, oh, I want to work with. And then I was like, no, this is actually, you guys are going to do this my way. And when I got clear about that, just of setting up the baseline, of setting up the communication process, like I set up production meetings that every week I was like, don't send me a million emails and wipe your hands clean, because that's what happens, is the technical aspect of the book. They're really good at sending you emails telling you that something is due tomorrow and sending you a novel. And I was like, no. We're not going to do that. We're going to get on the phone and we're going to talk. If I have questions for you, you're going to drop what you're doing to answer my questions. And they love to make you feel like they're doing you a favor. And they're not doing you a favor. It's their job.
Mm. When was that conversation, and how, and just so we have a timeline, because this book is coming out now in 2022. So when was that conversation?
That conversation happened a few times, but I will tell you, in 2021 is when things just coalesced. I mean, it was a really difficult, difficult thing. And then a more difficult thing happened. My mother ended up getting sick and dying of terminal cancer in the middle of this process. And as these things do, it just reset my perspective. Before, I was like, oh, I thought this was hard. And then my mother just died. So the making of this book is not the hardest thing I've ever done. And suddenly I was like, oh, this process has shrunk now. It used to take up all the space in the room and all the air in my lungs. And now it's a much smaller thing. And that just gave me perspective on what I needed. I was able to represent it from a clearer place. Mm. And I was also just really like, you guys are doing it my way now. I'm not trying to work with a process that does not work.
Got it. So I could talk to you about the publishing part all day long, because I think it's
fascinating. I know. It is fascinating.
I want to get to the reading. So if you would read a little bit from the introduction for us, and then I can ask you all my questions from my notes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. Illustrated Black History, Honoring the Iconic and the Unseen, is a history book like you've never seen before. Featuring full-page color illustrations beside biographies of Black history pioneers, the well-known and the obscure, Illustrated Black History is proof of the polymaths, a monument to movement makers, and a testament to those who toiled and triumphed. Here's George.
Introduction to Illustrated Black History, Honoring the Iconic and the Unseen, by George McCallman. I have to say that again. Introduction. I had a curiosity, This project was born out of an interest in a series of separate things that overlapped: the past and the present, my internal and external self, my understanding of my soul through a connection with my community. I was curious about knowing Black history better than I already did, and I was also curious to see if I was an artist. I had never allowed myself to explore two things in counterpose like that, and I reached a juncture in my life to inquire, if not now, when? I had the novel idea of doing a daily challenge and painting a Black history pioneer every day for a month, choosing the shortest month of the year. A simple yet ambitious idea, which bloomed out of my professional experience as an art director, tethered to my personal interest in identity. I had assigned lots of art to many artists over many years, and I knew that people worked well within parameters. So I gave myself some terms. I decided that I was going to research, write, and paint one pioneer a day. It seemed achievable. It seemed attainable. It was just brazen enough, and it gave me some room to observe my own process and work out my nerves. I limited the framework of the original series to black and white portraits. I knew that my inclination to think expansively about color would paralyze my momentum, so many colors, and sabotage my enthusiasm. That limitation forced me to see beyond the words of my research and focus on intangibles like line quality, composition, emotion, and the personality of the person I was rendering. I needed to meet my subjects where they were, to see the hardships and sacrifices, but also hear the laughter, feel the inner definition of self-reliance. I spent a lot of time communing with the people I was researching. So by the time my paintbrush hit the paper for each one, I had a lived-in sense of who this person might have been as an individual, and I trusted my perceptions. I found I was approaching each portrait differently, requiring a variety of tools. Sometimes I used acrylics, sometimes watercolor, sometimes pen and ink, sometimes colored pencil. Along the way, I got to know the body language of Edna Lewis, the matriarchy of Southern American cuisine, the quiet resolve of revolutionary artist, activist Amy Ashwood Garvey, the searching, curious eyes of Elaine Leroy Locke, progenitor of the Harlem Renaissance. I was basically starting from scratch each day. That realization was an epiphany. And parallel to that enlightenment, I recognized that is how I was going to be approaching Black history. That is how I was going to climb that mountain from the beginning again. This giant, impenetrable thing. I had to tease, massage, and release my unformed notions and become a student, throw down my defenses and learn. As I was doing more portraits, I began to be more afraid, not less. I was terrified the first week and then the second, the third week, and didn't stop being terrified until I had finished 29 portraits 29 days later. It was a leap year. I needed to be awkwardly honest. There was no historical anchoring in my initial exercise. There was no organized rigor. At first, I just went by feeling. I was looking around the internet inside various digital cubbyholes of information. When I did a search for, say, James Baldwin, Langston Hughes would pop up. This would lead to another person and perhaps another hidden accomplishment, which in turn led to pockets of history I had never realized or recognized. It felt as if I was in truly uncharted territory and reached the edges of space and found that there was a whole other universe beyond that. And it made me hungry to discover more because I didn't know enough to structure my approach from a historical lens. That approach was too intimidating. But that is also not who I am. I would have found that way impenetrable. I just wanted to give in. I wanted to trust my feelings, I wanted to find the luminaries who wanted me to find them.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. You say in your acknowledgments about doubt and insecurity. How did your doubt and insecurity, and even in the introduction you mentioned you were terrified, how did that help guide you bringing the book into existence and being committed to it for so long?
Yes. As Americans, one of the cultural narratives that we get all the time is that insecurity and doubt is a terrible thing, that it makes you, that it's weak, that it makes you lesser than. But the truth is that my insecurity and doubt about this project was a superpower. Hmm. And I got to trust that. If I was insecure about something, it meant that I could sink a little bit deeper in the exploration because I know how to do this. And for me, it was because I realized early on that the book I was making was pioneering, and it wasn't intimidating to me.
You have essays from Emile Wilbekin, Patrice Peck, and many, many others.
Oh, it's Marvin K. White, mm-hmm. Patrice Peck, Emile Wilbekin, Bryant Terry.
And Oriana Corin.
And Oriana Corin.
Yes. And getting their contributions, what did you want to illustrate from their words about Black history that wasn't already there in the portraits of these hidden figures that you were profiling?
The book went through several versions of itself before I found my footing and how I was going to put it together. The book originally was going to be separated by categories of industry. It was going to be, you know, the writers and the scientists and the blah, 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 and the blah, 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 blah. And I remember it was Josh Myers, who's an African-American studies professor at Howard. And one of the things that he pointed out to me was that where I was placing people was an issue because there were so many people who were polymaths. And so how would you decide where that person was going? Mm-hmm. And that structure began to fall apart, basically, because I would have to shrink a person to have them fit into a category. And then that was totally counter to the mission and the message of the book. Mm-hmm. And so I had to rethink and basically start over how I was going to organize the book and how I was telling people. And I decided that it would be alphabetical. And that would just simplify. And then every person could just be as they are. But then looking at that, I didn't want to see a book that was only alphabetical, because that would get repetitive after a while. And so I came up with that idea of having essays break up the literal structure of the book and also the spiritual, that there would be people representing different ways of accessing Black history. And I reached out to the writers that I really admire. I wanted to be written soulfully, not technically. And that's how I landed in this direction.
So you mentioned you have Bryant Terry mm-hmm. as one of your essayists, and he had that beautiful book that came out last year, Black Food, which is mm-hmm. very big and colorful, but about yes. foodways. And so,
which I designed, by the way.
I had a feeling there was going to be a connection here, and so I'm glad to yes. hear that it was. I'm like, they go together.
And so thematically, I call those books cousins, and I call them cousins the whole time, because even though it's a different set of people working on the book, like, they were both pioneering books mm-hmm. that I understood while I was making them, that they were revolutionary.
Yeah, Black Food is actually on the shelf in my kitchen.
But excellent.
He wrote in his essay, "Cookbook as memoir inspired me to add the texture of autobiography to my own cookbooks." So I want to ask you, because you profile a lot of chefs and culinary masters, Tony Tipton Martin, Edna Lewis, Leah Chase, James Hemings. What do cookbooks tell us about ourselves, or what do you think they tell us about ourselves that help discuss us as people?
Profiling so many food people for me made sense because there's an awakening conversation about what Black cuisine is. And that historically, so many things that we have done and contributed to this country has been minimized and erased. Because so much of our history, our own connection to our original culture was just destroyed. And so we have this, this way of interacting with each other where we actually know our history, but it's oral, it's not written. There's not a lot of documentation about the origins of Black cuisine in this country because it's just kind of been absorbed into the larger framework. And there's so many examples of us creating things that a white person can take, monetize, and then take off with. That we don't always have the strains of the origin points in this country. And I come from a part of the world where so much of what passed through Africa is still in my culture, you know, and I can see the patterns that then moved through the Middle Passage to the Americas. And so what I wanted to show is that Black people were defining cuisine in this country all along. There tends to be an all or nothing take around Black history that basically, if we don't have all of the information, then we can't tell the stories. And this book is a refutation of that. There are a lot of people in this book that there was no visual reference for them. I had to basically create out of nothing how I was rendering them. And I really trusted my ability to create a portrait of Cato Alexander while having no sense of what he actually looks like.
I find that in you talking about the importance of foodways and rendering these people who you may not have known how to capture because there was no other visual representation.
Yes.
That it is another way of conjuring and doing, as Oriana Corrin talked about in her essay, practicing rememory.
Yes.
You look at this book as a part of, not just as a part of your artistic practice, but as a contribution to what will become some other artist's act of rememory.
That is something that is at the backbone of this book, is this rememory. The fact that there is so much of our documentation in this country lost or destroyed or stolen or however you want to phrase it, dismantled, that there is still a way for us to reclaim and take back. The truth about food is that it's the most honest telling of history that we actually have. And nobody talks about food in that way. Food is historical, is actually true history. Because whether there is documentation or not, where ingredients, where trees are planted, when you see things out of sequence, that is actual. That is the earth showing its history. I'm from the country of Grenada, where, you know, Indian culture, Indian cuisine is huge. It is a huge remix of it. It's like, you know, my Indian friends from India talk about basically the differences in West Indian cuisine. Like roti is one of my favorite things and I consume it ravenously, but it is not the same roti that Indians from India eat. I used to design a magazine called Whetstone that was committed to the idea of reclaiming the passage of food as an accurate telling of history. Because the history books are not always honest. Dates don't tell you everything. You know, food tells you more honestly where people lived, who the people were that passed through a certain location, and what actually happened when they gathered together.
I would argue that history books, especially now, are intentionally dishonest.
Yes, I think so too. I was being diplomatic, but I think
we don't have to do that here.
I think history books are dishonest. I think because the people telling them are usually white, and they don't focus on what they don't know.
And my very first job while I was an undergrad was working at a textbook publishing company where I learned about how books are sold and how they get to different states and how one state can dictate what goes in a book for 26 states in the country. We won't dwell on that. But as I mentioned to you, I was really excited when I got the book. I was giddy.
Yes.
And I called my mom, who was an educator, and I was like, Mommy, look at this. I can't wait till my son, he has to do a project and he can use this book as a reference. And I was very, very excited about that.
Yes.
So I normally ask my guests, what do they want readers to take from their work? But I want to know, what do you want students and young children especially to take from this work?
Nikisha, that is the reason this book looks the way it does. I designed it deliberately to be accessible to children, teenagers, seniors. I wanted everyone to feel, I mean, children are going to look at it and the first thing they're going to be stimulated by is the art. And I wanted the art to be joyful. I wanted it to be chromatic. I wanted it to be dazzling. I wanted it to stimulate their senses. I have received so many notes, emotional notes. I've spoken to so many people who have now seen the book. I have witnessed grown people crying, looking through this book. And what it is we're being seen and we're seeing. And I received a letter from a contemporary, a Black contemporary, yesterday. And she said, if I had this book as a child, my perception of myself would be different today. And it is the truth. And we say, you know, representation matters. And you know, we have these phrases that are carted out in our culture today. And it does a disservice to how serious it is of what we're saying right now. That this country has been so cavalier in how it has told its stories that, of course, we as human beings, we need to see ourselves. And I come from a culture where we don't ask for permission for the things that we want to do. It was never not clear in my mind that I could do this. That was never the conversation. I've worked hard in my career to say that I'm overqualified, not because I have a huge ego, but because I have worked to claim that. And I don't need anyone's validation to tell me what I can do and what I can't do. And so I was always clear that this was mine to do or not do.
Hmm. Thank you, Ashe. So I want to move to a speed round before I let you go for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
My favorite book? There have been a few books in my life that have kind of changed my cells. V.S. Naipaul's A House for Mr. Biswas, which is not a book that most people know, but it's a book about the Caribbean. Mm. When I read my first Jamaica Kincaid book, and it was like the first books I read, I come from a family of readers. And we're not fancy literary people. It's just like, we just read. My grandmother, who's 99, reads more than anyone I know. And I'm doing a story about her for the New York Times of just basically how her love of books inspired me. You know, we tend to kind of minimize our love of books to Oprah, like we didn't love books before she came along. So insulting. That my grandmother was the person that really centered how much you can travel into other universes in reading. But the book as an adult that just really just, it just like left me sprawled out on the floor is Toni Morrison's Jazz.
Okay. Who was your favorite author?
Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, definitely. Go Tell on the Mountain had a similar effect on me. But my favorite book, just in terms of language, and I think no one uses language better, is Gabriel Garcia Marquez. When I read Love in a Time of Cholera, I was just passed out on the floor. His wordplay, his use of words together, I was just like, this man thinks like a poet. Just dazzling, dazzling. And then I read 100 Years of Solitude. I've reread Love in a Time of Cholera maybe 10 times.
Hmm. Who is your favorite artist?
A married couple by the name of Leo and Diane Dillon. It's a husband and wife that they illustrated lots of Black-focused children's books in the 70s and the 80s. They illustrated tons of Black children's book. Ashanti the Zulu, which I think is one of the best children's books ever made, is basically about all the phrases, like A through Z, of everyday words and meanings in Black culture. But the illustrations are rapturous. They just, it's a whole world unto itself. Their use of color and composition and Black features and Black hair, just it took hold of me. And I first saw these books as a teenager, and I still think they're some of the best illustrated books I've ever seen.
Okay. So if you were a color, what color would you be?
A color that I keep coming back to that I use a lot declaratively is in the red and orange family. Like, red just commands your attention. And red next to Black is just like one of the most potent color combinations I have ever seen. It's a color that commands your attention. You can't ignore red when it is in your face.
Hmm. What brings you joy?
Making art. Everything else that I represented in the making of this book is true. One thing that was not hard in any stage of this process was communing with these pioneers to make their portraits. It was a joy and a dream the whole time. The art was just, it was spiritual, making this art.
And so my final question for you today is, when you are no longer here and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the legacy of words and work, visual and literary, that you left behind?
That everything I do is a love letter to my community.
Hmm.
In one sentence.
Thank you, George.
Thank you so much. This was such a delight talking to you. Thank you for your thoughtful questions. I could keep talking to you all day.
Big thank you to George McCallman for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out George's book, Illustrated Black History, Honoring the Iconic and the Unseen, out now from Harper One. And if you're not following George, check him out on the socials. He's at McCallman Co. on Instagram and Twitter. And that's McCallmanCo, McCallman Co. on Instagram and Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with George about why he didn't want his book to come out during Black History Month. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Toni Ann Johnson, author of the short story collection Light Skin Gone to Waste.
I did submit portions of my novel to two different mentors, and they both didn't like it, and they both told me a version of, you should throw this out and start over, write another novel. But I didn't do that. I didn't listen to anybody. I had negative criticism of that novel, but I listened to myself, and I submitted that novel when it came out to the NAACP Image Awards, and I got nominated. And so I was like, ugh. Yeah, what you say?
I love it.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.